I'm just going to get us going here. Today is April 29th, 2019. This is Karen Brewster here with...
Jeremy Watson.
You go by Watson most of the time?
I do.
Okay. And this is for the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park. You see, I'm tired too. Oral History Project. So, when did you first start working up there?
1980.
And what did you do before that?
I was a work leader at Trails and at Glacier National Park from 76 to 80. Before that, I was in Sitka National Historical Park.
And what did you do in those other places?
I built the trails in Sitka at the cultural center there.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with it?
Yep.
And before that, I was at Rocky Mountain National Park when I was an undergrad then at Boulder, University of Colorado. And I worked there for 2 years, and then I went to Alaska in 75, and then I went to Glacier in 76, and then I went back to Skagway in 1980. They asked me to come up there to rehabilitate the old Chilkoot Trail.
Okay, and where are you from originally?
Chicago.
What got you into doing trail work?
Well, I'm a Vietnam combat veteran. I was a Navy Corpsman with the Marine Corps. I came back and I was a medevac corpsman out of Da Nang. I came back to Chicago and worked after I left the country in 1971. Started working for the Veterans Hospital in Chicago. I worked there for about a year, and I was pretty burned out with medical care by that time and trauma, which is what I dealt with for 4 years.
Yeah.
And so I went back to school in Colorado, at the University of Colorado, as an undergrad, and I started working for the park in the summertime.
And what's your undergrad degree in?
East Asian Studies.
Oh, it has nothing to do with... the built environment or the unbuilt environment?
No, it didn't, but I mean, I have a history of that. I mean, I did a lot of that when I was a kid.
Okay. What do you mean?
I worked with my grandfather and my father.
Doing construction?
Doing construction work and doing renovations. And
okay.
So I started doing that, I mean, but my medical background was a benefit in the backcountry, of course.
Right.
I worked in the backcountry for 30 years.
Okay, so Skagway was... Tell me about rehabilitating the trail, what you had to do that first year.
Well, when I came on board there in 1980, came up there in May of 1980, and was able to drive. That was the first year that the Klondike Highway was open.
Hmm.
So I was able to drive... I drove all the way up from Colorado to Skagway, and then I got there and the park was very small then. It was just we were above the liquor store where the office was, and I had a crew of two women and a man. I can't remember his name, but none of them had any experience whatsoever in construction. So, and they had no base camp. They had, the guy who preceded me, I don't recall his name, but he had done a long study the year before I got there, and all he did was lay out where he was going to blast. He came from, I think, North Cascades.
So the trail was not obvious anymore? From what it had been historically?
No, in places it was obvious, but most of the bridges were in disrepair or ready to fall in or non-existent. The trail was overgrown in most places. And they had, as I said, no base camp for the people to set up their camp so they could work. And so I set that up at Canyon City. And I spent about 2 days scouting the trail by myself, and then located a place up on the knoll so we could see all the way down the Lynn Canal. And then we, I had to fall some trees there, and then we had a helicopter come in and bring in our stuff, because the gear that I had put together the gear, we had very minimal equipment because they had ordered nothing. And nobody there had any experience doing that kind of work. But I was fortunate enough to meet on some of the first days that I was in Skagway, Roy Nelson, who you interviewed earlier, and Roy was of immeasurable value to me. And I mean, we were ostracized in that town because we worked for the park. They used to throw rocks at my car, call me an effing hippie, and just give us crap all the time because we worked for the Park Service. So we were sort of persona non grata there.
Even with Roy, who was from Skagway.
Roy took a lot of heat because he's one of the first guys to to work for the park, because everybody else was working for the railroad, but they didn't like the fact that he'd taken a job with the Park Service. But he did anyway, because Roy is Roy. A very skilled man and multifaceted in his knowledge. So I found this location, and then we had the helicopter fly in, but the pilot was not what I was used to working with in Vietnam, because that's what I was in, helicopter medevacs. And he couldn't get all the way in, so he dropped the load about halfway down the hill. And we had to haul all the stuff up pretty much from the bottom of the hill up to I don't know if you've ever been to the base camp on the Chilkoot.
In August I will, but I have not been there yet.
You'll know, Ben, it's straight up. It's up on the knoll. You just walk up the face of the hill. But...
Well, what kind of gear and supplies was it that then you had to carry?
Oh, we had to carry chainsaws up and gas and food and tents and tarps for the... tarps to set up a shelter. We just had a lean-to shelter. We didn't have any enclosed shelter at all. So it was very minimal.
And did you have lumber to build shelters or to do trail construction?
No, we didn't have anything at that time. I immediately started ordering materials so that we could start replacing bridges. We did some of the lower work first on the bridges, but we had to open up the trail up above because it was completely grown over in a lot of locations. There was, the steps, there weren't any steps. It was really slick, and it was a dangerous trail to work on.
Yeah.
And the problem for me is that I had a crew that had no skills. So I was able to convince... Dick Sims, who is the superintendent then, that I needed Roy to help me on the trail, because I had to have somebody that knew knew how to work. And so that first year was pretty tenuous, and it was just hard to get a lot of work done, because it would be like, you know, I don't know if you've done any trail work before, but it's hard work.
I haven't, because it's such hard work. I'm aware.
I'm paying for that now, but...
I've hiked enough to know how hard it must be to put in some of those
trees. If I dropped a tree, I've usually got guys who can help me pick it up and with sweet hooks and carry it to the site, but these guys would pick it up, and then I'd be carrying one side, and then they'd just drop it. And they drop it. And I've just, almost killed me a number of times. I'm just going, I can't deal with this shit. So it was very difficult. I was able to get a lot of the brush cut.
But so you didn't start down at Dyee at the Beaver Ponds and work your way up? You started.
No, the Beaver Ponds weren't there then.
Oh, that's true.
The Beaver Ponds, they didn't come into existence until early 90s.
But still, you didn't start at the bottom and walk your way up. You started
I did the whole trail first, but we needed a midway point to set up a camp.
Right.
And then after we set that up and got that together and got our material stuff in there, then I could start working on the lower end.
So you worked both directions from
Canyon
City.
But I needed a base camp from which to operate.
Right.
And I didn't want that to be lower on the trail. They suggested... sawmill, which is that was of no use to me. That's only 3 miles in.
Right. So Canyon City.
Canyon City's about 7.8 miles right. in, so it's about halfway.
So you were doing trail from Dyea to the Canadian border?
Correct.
Okay.
But we didn't do, I wasn't able to, due to the fact, the nature of the crew, I wasn't able to do a lot that year
right.
as far as, I was able to put in some bridges. But that I pretty much did that by myself until I got Roy, which is only about midway through the season.
Mm-hmm.
And so we, and then I came down to the lower end and cut brush and opened that up. But I still didn't have the right people, nor the materials. And so that year I ordered lots of materials, lots of 3x12x20 foot stringers for the bridges and 4x12x20 foot stringers for the bridges. And I ordered a lot of 6x6 stringers for the 4x12s were for the decking. The stringers I ordered, they got the wrong stuff, so they got 4x4s, which were useless for me. So
what's a stringer?
Stringer is what the bridge deck is laid on. It goes from one end of this from one embankment to the other.
It's all one piece?
Yeah.
Oh.
That's a stringer. It's usually 20 foot. It's about as much as you can get on milled lumber.
Mm-hmm. And if you have to have a longer span, you have to put...
Oh, yeah, cut a tree down.
You have to put something in the middle?
Well, I did that too, but that's a whole other story. Those are piers.
Oh, piers. I couldn't remember what they were called.
Yeah, piers. We did that on the part of the tie that splits off and comes down. Along the trail that comes goes through that area you called, referred to as the beaver pond, which was
right.
which was not a beaver pond then. Yeah, so there was a couple places there, and there was a lot of bank erosion. There was the Chilkoot Trail is it's a narrow valley there. It's not very wide.
Right.
But above it is historically, there's been and it's all glacial fed. So whenever it would rain for a couple of days, it would flood.
Mm-hmm.
So the flooding was a constant problem. And so the banks were all cut, and the campgrounds were all... the cabins were a mess, and the whole thing just needed total renovation, mm-hmm. restoration.
So did you decide where to put the campgrounds?
No, the campgrounds at that time, there was one at... at Finnegan's, which was later closed. There was one at Finnegan's Point, which is improved two or three different times. There was that area was always flooded, so we had to build a whole drainage system through
wow.
there. And then there's another one at the Canyon City, which had a cabin that was built in the 1950s by prison labor.
Oh, right.
And the same at Sheep Camp. And there's one at Pleasant Camp.
Where's Pleasant Camp? Okay.
Pleasant Camp is about 4 miles up from Canyon City.
Oh, okay. Okay, right.
You go Pleasant Camp and then Sheep Camp, then after Sheep Camp, there's no campgrounds. You go over the summit.
You go over the summit and then you're on the Canadian side.
And you're on the Canadian side. Then they can deal with you.
Right. And they do have campgrounds now.
Yeah, they have some.
Right. Well, it sounds like a lot of work. Hard work.
It was an incredible amount of work, and it is made even more difficult by the fact that I didn't have a trained crew.
Yeah.
But then there are a couple of streams there that the source of the Taya comes right out of comes down from the pass, and it's a very swift-moving stream, and it can get very deep, very dangerous. So we decided that we needed to put in a suspension bridge there because I didn't have the timber at that area to get across that stream. As I did, what we did on the lower end of the trail, we decided to put in two suspension bridges, one at Canyon City, one at... what we call 12-mile or 11-mile bridge. And those are both suspension bridges. And Roy was my lead man on both of those.
Do you need those to be engineered?
They had drawings for them, but we engineered them. We made, they brought an engineer down from the region who talked with us and said, you guys can build this. But we had to move 60,000 pounds of cement. And I think the total stuff we had to fly up was well over 85,000 pounds of equipment.
Wow. Now, did that helicopter get it in the right place?
That helicopter got it. We got a good helicopter pod at that time. We used an old Dewey helicopter that can hold 3,000 pounds. But, well, it took almost a week to haul everything in. I mean, we had cement. We had to store that. We had to build a base camp for the guys who were working on that bridge. And then they had received these logs from some Sitka, mm-hmm. and they shipped them up on the barge to Skagway. And they got in the year that I was there, but I couldn't do anything with them then. And so we had those skidded into the site where I was going to use them in the winter.
Okay.
They used a cat to bring them in and set those up, but they were old logs and they were rotted on one side. But they were still viable because I cut the rot off of it and then actually cut a deck into the bridge.
So did you have sort of one of those
lumber makers?
Lumber things on chainsaws?
Yeah, we couldn't use it on this because the wood wouldn't handle it. I mean, it was not in great, but they wanted to use them. So I did the best I could with what I had. But that was the second year. And then I had, I got a hold of a number of guys that I knew from other parks. They came up and we had eight people that worked on the trail that year.
Wow.
And none of the people that were on the first year came back again.
Except for Roy.
The other people they quit about mid-season. They just said they couldn't handle the work. So it was Roy and I for that first season. I don't know what I would have done without Roy. Roy and I are best friends. So.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I was thinking that, you felled trees. So some of the bridges are made out of wood from the local trees.
Yeah, what I did is we would go in and try to cull the trees that we thought were damaged in some way. And we never cut anything that there wasn't other timber that could grow into that site. And I'm a firm believer of integrating any construction into the landscape. So we were very particular about, clearing, taking down the trees. And, of course, we damaged a lot of the ground plane there when we skidded them, because we had to have to skid the logs in.
Yeah.
And we used rollers that we cut in the forest, and then we used to come along and we used a power winch, that used a chainsaw.
Oh, right.
Winch, and we used that, but it was still a hell of a task. And we put two piers in that river.
Wow.
And then we filled it with rock. We had them haul up rock in the wintertime as well, truckloads of rock. And then we filled those piers in with that. So I built two piers. While I was building those, Roy was starting on the footings for the suspension bridges.
So those piers are on the regular bridges. They're not on a suspension bridge.
No, you don't use piers on a suspension bridge. Suspension bridge is a suspension
bridge. That's why it's a suspension bridge.
That's why you call it a suspension bridge. But we had we were in the river all day long, I mean, and then we had to fill those in and then fill in the prow of the pier so that when the river comes downstream, that it would cut the force of the river off so that it wouldn't get underneath and take them away, which it eventually did anyway. But.
So, yeah, you're standing in the cold river water all day?
All day.
Yeah, because in, big bridge building, they divert the water, but you didn't have that ability.
We don't have that kind of capability.
Right.
Everything we did out there was manual tools. Yeah. Chainsaws was the best, was the most extensive tool we had.
Wow.
So no, we didn't have any cranes or anything. No, everything we did was by brute force. All our work was that way. I mean, we had to haul, when we built our cabin, we had to haul cement up from Canyon City on our backs, and about 70, 80 pounds a piece, and then haul it up to build the footers for our cabin and haul all the lumber up.
How many miles is that between?
From Canyon City?
Yeah.
It's about a half a mile.
Okay.
But as I say, you'll find out what that
is. No,
looks
I
like.
Mean, if you're 80 pounds, a half a mile is a long
way. We usually carried packs at about 60 pounds every day.
Yeah.
Every day to work, because we had chainsaws, gas. And then we would we'd leave a lot of our tools on site. But
yeah.
I mean, I'm scattered here. I'm just moving around.
That's
to
okay.
A lot of different sites here. But
right.
It was those first 2 years, 3 years were pretty or tough. I mean, we didn't have any place to get dry because all we had was a tarp, and so we were wet most of the time.
Well, that's why I was wondering if you built yourself a shelter as the first thing at your base
camp. No, we had to get clearance to build a shelter first. Even though that land's on state land, it's not federal land.
Okay.
They only have an easement through there, and unless they've changed it. That's the way it was at first. It took us a while to get the permission to build something there. But that took us a long time because we could only get what we... the materials we got, we sort of scrounged around for and got them. But that took... it was, let's see, 2 years before we had... just a floor and walls, and we still had a tarp. We didn't have anything closed in. It was probably 4 years in before we had windows, had a roof.
That's you guys are tough.
Yeah.
That's
yeah, I mean, you were wet. You were miserable most of the time because of all the rain, but...
Yeah.
But, I mean, it was still a great work, but then we had problems with bears and lots of problems with bears.
Such as?
Well, once we got the doors on, put a door on with a 3 by 3/4 inch plywood door. And it put a lock on it with a hasp, and the windows were just screened in. We didn't have any glass in them then. We had no roof, just a tarp. And they came in, and the bears came up, and we had our food in boxes that were locked up. But these bears came up, and this is when we were not there, and they ripped the door off the hinges, got in, and tore all the boxes open, threw the food all over the place, totally destroyed, like, I don't know, $1,000 worth of food for all of us. Because Roy and I were at that camp, and Andy Robertson and Bob Spinhoven, Clark Likes, they were all up above. But it was funny, the bears got in there and they had, I think Roy had this Aunt Jemima phony ass pancake syrup. And I had pure maple syrup and a glass. And he had something that was in a plastic container. The bear just said, I don't want anything to do with that shit. But he got the cap off of it, just poured it out on the floor, and he ate that, but he wouldn't eat the other stuff.
So the bear ate the maple syrup, the good stuff?
Yeah, he ate the maple syrup, didn't touch the other shit. But they went through the food, boy, I'll tell you. And then there's a ranger there. When after that happened, there's a ranger that was Jay Cable. He used to be the chief ranger there.
Right.
You know him?
No, I know the name. That he was one of the early rangers.
Yeah, Jay was a different kind of a guy.
What does that mean?
I'd rather not say.
Okay.
I wasn't particularly fond of him. He had absolutely no idea of how to do stuff, the work that we were doing. I mean, he was completely oblivious to it, and I had to convince him every time that this is what we needed to do. And he was difficult to deal with. he wasn't very supportive, but I mean, that was just who he was. I mean, he was a decent enough guy, but he didn't understand what maintenance was about.
Right. You weren't even doing, you were doing construction and
safety purposes. He had no idea how to do any of that stuff. And so everything we did, we had to, you know, I had to order everything. I had to see that the helicopters were there. I had to order all the slings and nets to haul our stuff in. And I mean, I taught him a lot of stuff how to do it, but it wasn't very easy to deal with him sometimes.
And you were crew leader for the trail. Yeah. Is that what your title was? Do you know whose idea it was to start doing that trail reconstruction?
I think it was dictated by the region. Dick Sims was the superintendent when I first got there. He was a character. Dick was a good guy, though, but he'd been tossed from Crater Lake. I don't know if you remember any of that stuff, but there was this problem with the sewage, the water treatment plant. A lot of people got sick.
At Crater Lake?
Yeah, when he was the superintendent there. So they sent him up to Skagway.
Is that your phone?
Yeah, it's all right. It's going to be on your... You want me to turn it off?
Yeah, I forgot to ask you to turn it off. Or we just have to listen to the music for a little while.
It's not bad.
So Rick Sims... Dick Sims. Yeah, I don't know anything about him. I mean, I've seen his name.
He was a superintendent when I got there. God damn it. Yeah, we should... I should have started with the... I remember going into the office for the first time and going upstairs above the liquor store and then meeting Dick. He was sitting on his chair with his feet up on the desk and reading a newspaper. He went, "Hey, Dick, hello." And he went, because nobody else was in the office, he went, "Oh, yeah, how you doing, man?" But he was a real character. And I remember the first year when they had, like, the end of the year, you know, sort of pep talk for the employees. And there weren't very many people that worked there then. There were a lot of people that worked on restoration, but I mean, I only had a few people on the trails at that time, just Roy and I. But Roy and I were there, and a couple of the rangers, Chaz Dentz, and Christy Heron. And so we're up there with all these permanent employees. And Dick looks at us and he said, "Well, you know, the only reason any of us are here is because we're all losers."
That's a great pep talk.
Yeah. And he goes, "The only reason they sent us up here is because we screwed up somewhere else." And I went, "Hey, speak for yourself, man."
Yeah.
And everyone else is, I mean, the other people are mortified, all the permanent employees, and Roy and I are in the back just laughing our ass off because... It was hysterically funny, because that was why Dick was there.
Right.
Because he had screwed up and got sent there. But
you chose to go to Alaska and to go there.
Yeah, they asked me to come up there, and I mean, I just thought it was a great opportunity. And it was. I mean, I stayed there 20 years.
Every summer? Or did you stay during the winters?
No, I worked, sometimes I worked on restoration crew. But mostly I was just, I was there from... March until late November.
Oh, okay. It's more than just summer.
Yeah.
Because in March, you're starting to plan out
the
work.
Yeah, in March, we're getting all the materials together. And because, you know, when we go up on the trail, you got to have all your food together, all your equipment together, because you're going to haul everything in the spring.
Right.
So you have to have each site planned out where you're going to be able to work at. And then you have to find out the place to store the materials where it's going to be safe and as dry as possible, and then haul all the food in for, you know, you're essentially there for 5 months. So you haul everything in, and what you don't haul in, you got to haul it into your back. The first year we worked 10 fours, 10 down, 4 on, 10 on, 4 off.
10 days on, 4 days off?
Right.
Yeah, so that was later my question. Did you come into town? In those 5 months, did you come off the trail and get a break and come into town?
Yes, we did. Yeah. You'd come in, well, you'd come in one day, and then you'd be in town 2 days, and it's time to go back up again. And then we'd hike back in. We used the Zodiac to get across the Lataya River, and that cut off the first hill. And then we would hike from there, and then carry all, you know, use the 70, 80-pound pack to carry all your food in for that next shift, because everything that you had up there, it's like rice and, you know, staples. But if you wanted to bring in fresh food, then you had to haul it on your back.
Yeah, and there was probably some supplies or equipment or something that maybe you needed,
needed
that you hadn't
planned for. Yeah,
we
needed to bring stuff in, like we'd have to bring in a chip, something up with a chainsaw or something. But I ordered stuff every year to replace the stuff that we had.
Mm-hmm.
Until we had all the equipment that we needed. But I think I told you this before. The person who was there prior to my arrival had developed this whole scheme for just blasting rock every damn place on the trail. I mean, he just had no sensitivity to the landscape in this historic fabric of the land. I mean, this is an historic trail. It's an historic park. But he wanted to blast everything. So they had gotten this Pongiar rock drill in. I mean, I had a blasting license from that I used to clear snow in Glacier, but I just said, that's ridiculous. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to destroy all this historic fabric. I mean, that's an historic trail and blast it. I mean, it was amazing. He had detailed maps where he's going to blast the whole damn thing out.
Well, I'd say if you do that, then you're not following the historic route. That's correct. Where
see,
it was going to go.
The problem was is that people that were working there had... at that time, there was... I can't remember who was the archaeologist then. Carl was there for a long time. Carl was a good guy. He was easy to work with.
Yeah, I don't know if he was there yet in 1980.
Yeah, I don't remember who was there, but they had no idea. They thought this guy had a great plan. I just said, no, you can't do this. He said, we don't have clearance to do this. I said, I'm not going to do it.
I'm surprised that archaeologists would have gone along with it.
I don't know if they did. I just saw it and said, there's no way. And then when Carl got there, I just said, this is their plan. And I said, I denied it. And he just said, good, because we can't do any of this.
Right. So did you have a survey to know where the trail had been? Some kind of an old map or something?
No, I mean, you could tell. There were remnants of it.
Enough you could tell?
Yeah, there was enough I could tell, but I mean, there were places like around Finnegan's where it was up to your knees walking through there. You used to take off your boots and walk through that.
Up to your knees of water?
Yeah.
Oh. Because the river had changed?
Well, because the water had come up in high in the springtime, and it's flooded that whole area out. And then the place where the beaver ponds is at, that was always a... problematic for water as well.
Right. And then the scales and all that steep rock part, I mean, how would you know where the trail was? Because it doesn't get worn down by foot traffic.
There were cairns.
Oh, there were.
There were cairns sporadically. We just kind of had to figure it out. And we improved we redid the cairns. Because those of them had fallen down. Uh-huh. I mean, the place was in total disrepair. They just, nobody really done anything. The only work that had been done prior to my arrival was by this guy who mostly did just this study on explosives.
Well, that's what I was wondering about, that rock part. Maybe it's obvious, you know, of where it would make most sense to go up. Maybe the landscape tells you that.
Yeah, I'd worked on trails for 6-7 years before that. I knew where the trail should be.
Yeah.
I mean, it may not... the river up there changes everything.
Right.
It's the most dynamic stream I've ever been around in my life, so... Mm. I mean, I had to replace bridges sometimes every couple of years because it would just take them out. We built a whole new campground in, I don't know, late 80s. And... around sheep camp, we put a new sheep camp in, built a new sheep camp campground. Spent 2 months building it, hauling in the sand, building all the
platforms and
no platforms, just clearing all the brush and putting in sand and make it so they're really nice campsites. It was gone the next year.
Wow. From flooding?
Took everything that we worked on for 2 months out. And then it started to take out Pleasant Camp, and we built a log jam in there. We spent a month in the river there.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, all my time was spent in the river. We anchored the banks at 6.5 mile bridge. That bridge was taken out in the flood, and we had to replace that.
Do you remember what year?
6.5 mile bridge was built in 1984. The suspension bridges were built in 82 or 83. Took us 2 years to finish those. I mean, they were like 15, the anchor was like 15 feet wide, 15 by 20 by 12 feet deep.
Wow.
And then we had to fill all that in with cement.
And all by hand?
All by hand. We mixed it all by... So I called up Jay when we were building that. I just said, Jay, I need another cement mixer. Portable, as light as you can get it. I said, it's because we're going to have to haul it across the river by rope. He sends up a 1,000-pound, huge cement mixer. Hand mixer, but it was enormous. I mean, we couldn't move it. You know, we put it on one side, had to stay over there. So then we had to get another smaller one.
I didn't know they made small portable cement mixers.
Oh yeah, they make them about this wide. But this one was huge. It was a great cement mixer. But we flew it in by helicopter and then put it on one side, and then we had to fly it from Canyon City up to Sheep Camp. I mean, up to 12 Mile Bridge. You have pictures of those? I've got pictures of them.
Not yet. I will when I go up there.
Yeah, you know, we did a rudimentary cultural landscape report for that.
Yeah.
Samson Ferrara and I, who was a classmate of mine at graduate school.
And so after that first year, did your crews become better? You had more people?
Absolutely, because I brought them up. A lot of them I brought up from Glacier National Park. I brought some guys up from Rocky Mountain National Park. A couple guys from Olympia. I got people who knew what they were doing.
So you got to make the hiring decisions.
Right.
And so when you were up there in March, ready to order supplies and everything, you already knew how many people were going to be on your crew and who they were?
Yeah. Pretty much. I mean, I needed the people that I needed people that had experience, because it was rough dealing with people who don't know what they're doing. It's a dangerous job. I mean, people get killed on those jobs.
Yeah.
And this guy, one guy that worked on that, the women were far, far, far superior to him, but he almost killed me a couple of times, you know. And I just said, you can't come back. You don't, he goes, I can't do this kind of work. I go, yeah, I know that.
So is there a typical year how many people you'd have, or did it vary on what you were doing?
When we were doing the suspension bridges and a lot of the early log bridges, because the log bridge we built at a mile and a half is 70 feet long. And we built two piers on that, and so we had a stringer coming from the west bank to the mid to the pier, and then we had another stringer going from that pier to the other pier, and then from that pier to the other bank. And then we cut out the deck, and then I filled the deck with, put screen on the deck, where I'd actually taken out and just cut with a chainsaw, cut a groove into the deck, into the logs. Was where it was rotted. I took it down to good wood, and then I put screen in there, and I filled that with gravel, and then I made a deck out of it. It was a temporary fix for what we needed to do.
Mm-hmm.
They eventually brought in a steel, prefabricated piece of crap.
I was just going to ask you if the bridges you built, are any of them still there?
A couple, not many. They don't last long up there. 20 years is about the most you're going to get out of any wooden bridge up there. The suspension bridges are there. They'll be there for a long time. They're creosoted.
Oh, they are.
After you put those in, we stop using creosote.
But yeah, everything you did was out of wood. You didn't use any metal?
No.
Not even for the suspension bridges?
Well, yeah, we did on those.
Oh, those, okay.
You gotta have metal, you gotta have metal cable.
Oh, right, okay. But, yeah. I'm trying to picture a suspension bridge.
Yeah, the metal cable, the suspender cable is about 2 inches.
Right.
OD. And then you have the deck, you have the cable that goes underneath the decking, which is, and then it's the cables come down from the main cable to the deck that holds the deck in place.
Oh, okay.
And then the anchor points come up over the top. When you see it, you'll be amazed because we raise those things by hand. Put the top on by hand. They're about 18, 19 feet tall.
I can't even fathom doing it all by hand. How many people did you have on that crew?
8. But we were split up. We're usually 4 and 4 and 4.
Where did the other... So 4 on the...
4 what? On the log bridge and 4 were on the suspension bridge. Roy was the lead man on the suspension bridges. And then we all worked together on the suspension bridges. We finished up the... So we did those... We got the suspension bridges... And the log bridge done in the second year. And the engineer was like, he couldn't believe that we got it done. He didn't even know how the hell we got this stuff up. Because when you get to, especially 12 mile, the bridge, you'll just see it took us a long time to get those things up. I thought you were going to get killed on that job.
But you got it all up in one season?
We got most of it up in one season. We finished it the second season. And then, like I said about Jay Cable, then he's just going, well, you guys didn't get much done this year. I'm going, what, are you kidding? But yeah, they had no conceptual it was unable to conceptualize what it takes to do with construction like that.
Yeah.
He just thought it was just something you could just get together and finish. So we don't have, any power equipment. You know, we have no heavy equipment. Everything is by muscle here.
Right.
Because we'd have 100-foot stringers, and we'd carry those in by hand. Or when we couldn't move them
You said you had the power winch.
The power winch. Sometimes that would break down, so we just had to move them by hand on rollers. And then when we built the bridge at 6.5 mile, we didn't... the only sand we had was downstream... And gravel to do the approaches. It was downstream and it was up this hill, this little knoll. So what we had to do is we had one guy on the back of the wheelbarrow and 2 guys on the front with all roped in. They're like 2 horses. And then they pulled and I pushed and they pulled up the hill. I was just like having a... This team of oxen carrying the whole... It was pretty funny, but it was hard. It was hard-ass work. But that's the kind of stuff that we did all the time. It was just... you just had to figure out how to do it. You know, because there was nothing... It was just... that's why most of us had our knees replaced or our backs are screwed up or... I don't think any of us are untouched by the work we did then.
No, it's hard work. Well, it's interesting that there were women on the cruise.
Just 1 year. There are now.
Right.
It wasn't... I had no aversion to that. In fact, Polly, the one woman that worked on a crew the first year, Shawood fired her back. Polly learned the skills. She was good, but she wanted to go back to Haines. But the other two didn't want anything to do with it. They couldn't handle the work, so... And then most people didn't want it. A lot of the men couldn't handle the work.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, like you say, nowadays there are women, but even 1980, 82, women doing that kind of work was still maybe not so common.
No, it was very uncommon. But as I said, Polly was fine. I would have fired her back. She was a good worker.
But the rest of the crews, most of the time, it was all men.
When you, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think many people wanted to have that job.
No.
The ones that did were, you know, I mean, you busted your ass. That's the only way you could do it. I mean, we had, we eventually built platforms. We built a helicopter pad for the, Roy and I built the helicopter pad for that site, for our base camp. We used to just land on a rock. And you'd have to keep the engine going so that he didn't go rolling down the hill.
And then you built all the campgrounds and the shelters and everything?
No, we didn't build shelters. The only shelters that's up there is, we built the ranger station,
yeah,
the sheep camp.
Yeah.
But that was the only thing. There's the only other shelter is the one at Canyon City for the trail crew. And like I said, the cabins, I don't know what the... I haven't been up there in a long time.
Yeah. I think at Canyon City there is now some sort of a shelter so you could go in and dry out and stuff.
They had a cabin there. I don't know if they...
And so I don't know if that's an old cabin or a new one.
Cabin was built in the 50s.
Yeah.
But they never did any work on it.
So I don't know if it's that same one or another one.
They had another cabin at Sheep Camp.
So how did you guys all get along, the different crews, the different years?
We got along fine.
Because that's a lot of time together.
Yeah, I mean, Roy and I were together on that trail for 15 years. We spent more time together. I mean, each guy had his own individual tent.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought really good dome tents. And he kind of cleared a pad. You know, we didn't have wooden pads. Son of a bitch, I thought I turned this thing on. You want that?
It's okay. So everybody had their own
tent. The first year we had this guy we called Jimmy Joe. He was essentially useless. He didn't last, he quit. He quit about 2 weeks in. He said he couldn't handle the work. We had a couple of guys like that just couldn't. And one guy came up and worked for a week and just went, I can't do this. And then another guy just flew in. We were flying all his gear up. I said, okay, Larry, we're going to fly your gear up now. And I hear him on the radio down in Skagway. He goes, don't bother, man. I'm not coming up. I'm leaving. Came all the way up from Colorado to work on a job and quit the first day.
Wow.
Said he couldn't handle living out there.
He obviously didn't do his research before he took the job.
Well, he used to work. He worked at Rocky Mountain for 30 years, but he lived in a cabin in Rocky Mountain. There aren't a lot of people that want to live out there like that.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was going to say. I know it's tough, and to get along with people, you know, it's different than you go to an office and you have coworkers and you go home at night.
Yeah, the guys that they've got, like Mike Katze and Roy Nelson and Andy Robertson. Mike Byerly, we all got along fabulously well, but eventually it ended up there were just four of us up there for the whole trail. And what I did is put two guys at Sheep Camp, and then Roy and I stayed at Canyon City. And then when we worked up at Sheep Camp, we would just hike or above up to the top, the pass. We never liked Sheep Camp. There's a lot of spirits in Sheep Camp. There's a lot of stuff going on at Sheep Camp. I never did like being there. So we would just hike like 8 or 9 miles to go to work and then hike that, go back at night and get home like 10:30. We did that every day.
But so if you guys were split up, then like the guys at Sheep Camp did a project.
They worked from Sheep Camp to the top. And we worked from Canyon City
to Sheep Camp.
Sheep Camp.
And then what about below?
We did that on the first couple of days we were working.
Okay.
There wasn't a lot of stuff we needed to do on the lower end. Just mostly keep the brush cut.
And so the whole thing with the beaver ponds and all that boardwalk, that's all since, that's after you.
Yeah, the beaver pond, no, it was there before. It started when I was there. We came in one year and it was flooded more than usual, so we went out and got our waders on and went into the, there's like a little pond that was in there. And then I saw the dens. I go, oh shit, man, we got beavers in here. We're screwed. So at first we just tore a rent in their dam a bit so that we could drain. We didn't want to kill them. We just wanted to lower the water level so there wasn't back flooding the trail. So we did that one day. We came out 3 days later and shit, they'd have fixed all that and they even built it stronger. So then we brought in some steel culvert and we took and stuck that through the dam at four different locations to keep the water from water level at a viable level. And within a week, they completely stopped up all the...
They just filled the culverts?
They filled the culverts with mud and sticks and blocked it all out. And then we tore it out, and then they fill it up, and they tore it out, they fill it up. They're smart as hell. And the bears try to get at them sometimes, but man, their dens just kept getting bigger and bigger, and the water kept getting deeper and deeper. And
it's interesting why the bears didn't get rid of them.
You can't get at them.
Oh.
You ever see a beaver den?
Yeah, those lodges, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I thought maybe when they were swimming, the bears would go after them, but I guess they're...
No, they're too good. They're too smart. Yeah. They're smart, man. They're the best engineers going.
Yes, they are.
No, they get down in there. I could see once in a while. I could look down in there. I could see their eyes in there. But we didn't want to kill them. I mean, the same thing with the bears. I mean, they would tell us... People do dumb shit on the trail, and they just go, "We need to take that bear out." And I'd have to. Several times I'd track the bears, and then find them. One time they got into Bill Sell, who worked on the trail with me. He left his pack sitting on the trail, and he went up the trail about a half a mile, and then he came back, and his pack was gone. He couldn't find his pack. So I went up and got the 12-gauge at the camp. I rarely ever carried it. And I started tracking the bear because Bill was freaked out. He said, "I don't know where my pack is." So I tracked the bear, put in two cracker shells and then some slugs and then some buckshot and then slugs last. And I came up on the bear, and he was sitting up on his haunches, and he had both his paws like this, and he was eating Bill's peanut butter sandwich, just like he was like eating a sandwich out like of his paws. He was just sitting there with the pack open. And so I fired a cracker shell at him, just over his head. He looked at me like, "Is that your best shot, man?" And I went, "Okay, this is going to take more than one." So Then I got him another one. I hit him about right here in the shoulder. It doesn't really hurt him that much. It just scares him.
Right.
And he took off, and I got his pack back. But they wanted me to kill him. I just didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's their place. It's their world, too. So, in fact, I was told a number of times to destroy bears, and I just didn't want to do that. I ran them off. I'd track them, and then I just... keep after them until they took off.
Did it work, or did those bears come back?
No, they took off. Yeah. They came through our camp all the time. We had sort of a symbiotic relationship going. We didn't mess with them. They didn't mess with us. But I'd leave your tents open, you know, unzip your front of your tents, let them go in there. They're just inquisitive. And they sometimes you come back, your sleeping bag's sitting outside, and your pads are all outside, but they didn't... You know, when you used to close it, they'd want to know what was inside, so they'd take their claws and just rip a $300 tent apart and get at it. And I just said, "Well, we can't afford to do this, man."
So back to the beavers, they were so smart, they kept overriding your attempts to drain the water. What did you end up doing?
Then they ended up doing something I didn't want to do. They ended up building an elevated deck through there. It didn't work. And just because the river just kept going, I mean, the water just kept getting higher and higher. This was after I was not working. This is after, you know, I suffered a serious injury there.
Right.
I don't know if you're aware of that.
Well, I am, and I didn't know if we wanted to talk about it or we talk about it at the end. So just to finish the beaver thing, and then we can talk about it. So that, putting that elevated boardwalk was after you, and why didn't you think that was a good idea?
Because I knew it wouldn't work. I mean, they're using wood as a deck, which got really slippery. It was dangerous, and people fell off of it. And the river just, I mean, it just kept rising because they just kept building the dam higher.
Mm-hmm.
And then the more kits they had, the more beaver there were. I think they've finally given up and they were going to move the trail, which is what I wanted to do in the first place, is just move the trail up on the hillside and go back around it and stay on the high ground. Actually, I wanted to do that shit 10 years before they even showed up because there was still water there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Roy and I came down one year and it had been raining for weeks and the river went from about 8 feet to 25 feet in about a day and a half.
Wow.
And we came down and we hiked down from Canyon City and we got down to just before where the beaver ponds are at. There's a place that we call the Rock Garden. And there used to be actually a landing space for airplanes. But it's long since grown over. But Pat Moore, who used to work on the trail, who's unfortunately passed away from ALS, his dad used to land his plane in there. We got down to there, and we were carrying our packs to get out because we were coming out and got a little bit further down the trail, and the water just kept getting higher. First, it was at our knees. And then before we got to about 2.5 miles, the water was like right here.
Chest high.
Chest high. So we tied each other up. And then and Roy didn't swim.
Oh.
And so I took his pack, and I just said, I'll carry this across, and I'll come back and get you. Because he does not like water at all. A lot of Alaskans don't swim.
Yeah.
Because you fall in the water, you're pretty much shot anyway.
Yeah.
So we got out and hell, in fact, Cy came to get us and he took the Zodiac and he came almost to Finnegan's Point in the Zodiac.
Wow. That's Cy Dennis?
Yeah.
Senior?
Junior,
okay.
Cy Dennis Senior passed away. He never worked on a trail.
Okay.
Great guy. Did you know him?
No, I just know these names. I don't know them.
Cy Dennis is a great guy. He's another Vietnam vet.
Yep.
One of the best people I know in Skagway. His parents were wonderful people. One of the few Native families. Andy Barley.
Right.
Another tremendous individual. Andy helped us immensely on the logistically. He and Cy.
So you and Roy got through that deep water with the Zodiac?
Yeah. I mean, we were totally drenched. It was ice like ice water.
Oh, man.
I mean, we were freezing, man, because it was that way. It was up to our chest for about a quarter of a mile.
Now,
it was touch and go there for a while.
Did you guys have radio communication when you were out there on the trail?
Yeah, we had radios, but they rarely ever worked with the dam, and they were battery-driven. They're, you know, the big old radios. We didn't have, which had been great. It'd been have cell phones in those days, but we didn't have those.
You didn't have handheld VHF or anything?
No, we had radios that were, I mean, they worked okay, but the batteries, by the time after 10 days, the batteries were about gone. We didn't have any way to charge the batteries then. We had a generator later that we used, but only to charge batteries. Usually we charged like 8 or 9 batteries, took them up with us before we got up there.
So
every year was, you know, every year was a flood year. Every year was something. We had to repair something. It was as far as job security, you'd never be without a job on that trail. They're still having the same problems. Remember this guy came down from Anchorage once and was going, well, we'll put the campground right over here. This is by the old campground up at Sheep Camp. He goes, this looks really flat and it's nice. And I go, this is March. And he goes, yeah, so what? I go, well, give it another month and that's going to be a water. There's nothing but water in there. I said, you can't put a campground there. But these guys had come up, they have no idea what they were doing. So we'd have to, you know, we have to go through that a lot. But I mean, we had to change the campground to sheep camp, I don't know, 4 or 5 times. I could tell you some great funny stories about sheep camp.
Well, go for it if you want.
No, this is a great story. Roy will kill me for telling this story. So they used their infinite wisdom. They decided to use these outhouses that used a holding container, and then they would fly them out after they were full.
Mm-hmm.
And they're supposed to, like, you know, the heat from the sun was supposed to, like, drain a lot of the liquids out, but it never worked. So we brought the and they had like a little plywood cover on them. And so Roy and I tilted it over, and we brought the helicopter in, and it was my old buddy that came up and picked it up. And as it lifted off, the wind came up. It started to sail on us. This is the laughs of this day. And it blew the top off of it, the cover off of it. And then it tilted, and then it just drenched Roy.
Oh, God.
And then the pilot, I'm just going on the radio, I'm just going, hey, you're going to slow down, man. The wind's got sailing on that thing, starting to sail. He goes, yeah, okay, I'll get it out of here. So it goes over the campground, and then it tilts all the way up, and it just spreads shit and toilet paper all through the campground, all over their tents, everything.
Oh, man.
By the time he got to town, it was completely empty. But Roy, that was the first time I ever seen Roy get in the river. He didn't have to. Oh, God, I had to run in the woods and start because I couldn't stop laughing. He was so infuriated.
Oh, I would think so. I was going to say there must be things that didn't work, other things that didn't quite work out the way you
wanted. Oh, no, all the time. All the time. You had to do everything. You had to figure it out on the run. But that was a good thing about it. You know, it required a lot of ingenuity. You couldn't exist up there without that. And we couldn't exist out there with guys like Roy Nelson and Andy Robertson and all the guys who worked on the trails with us, and Mike Katze, who's now, he lives in Anchorage. He was a development, he's Australian.
Hmm. Well, it sounds like you enjoyed the challenge of trying to figure it out.
Oh, no, I enjoyed it immensely. That's the reason I stayed there. That and because I love working in the bush. I didn't want to work in town. I like being in the backcountry.
Even though it was really hard work and cold,
yeah,
and
didn't
miserable.
Bother me. I mean, you came out of there, you were, you know, you felt like 100% all the time. It was hard work, but you came out of there and you were a lot stronger than you were when you went in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we hiked for usually 10, 15 miles a day with big packs.
Right.
You know, no day packs for us.
No.
But it was, you know, it was challenging just to figure out how to do things because you had to do everything just with brute force.
Is there any particular part that you're especially proud of that you figured out and that you accomplished and it worked?
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea, the whole concept of trying to restore the trail and yet maintain some integrity as far as integrating our work into the landscape. That's what we worked hardest on. And making, when we did the job, you give us a month and you go back there, you'd never realize that we did that. So it wasn't and John Horder, the guy who used to work, who was the facility manager, another guy that I didn't particularly get along with all the time, he had a motto, just quick and dirty. He didn't care about any of that stuff. It wasn't important to him. He came from Port Angeles.
So he was in the maintenance department for the park?
He was a facility manager for maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't important to him. He just used to, you know, give me crap all the time because I paid attention to, you know, clearance for archaeological sites, and I cared a lot about, you know, if I cut limbs or something, I try to make it so you, I try to naturalize all that so that you didn't just go through this place and go, good God, they've cut everything down. I try to make it look as natural as possible. So that's why I'm proudest of that. And the fact that we, Roy and I work so, I mean, we have a lifelong friendship.
Right.
So.
Well, it sounds like you also cared about the quality of your work in terms of building bridges that were going to...
No, absolutely we did that. I mean, that was the whole thing. We didn't do anything that we didn't put our heart and soul into.
Mm-hmm.
There was no such thing with Roy and I just to just do something quick and dirty. It just wasn't who we were. I mean, I went toe-to-toe with him a lot of times with that, about that. Just, you're taking longer than it should to just get this done. Just cut him down. And it used to drive us nuts when you come up and just cut anything in sight.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't care. Came from a logging family, so they didn't have a lot of...
That was the guy from Port Angeles?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it would be a little frustrating to spend all that time on a bridge and do such a good job and then the next year have the river wash it out.
It was, but, you know, that's the river. The river never quits. It changed course all the time. I mean, there was one place that was about 30 feet from the about 30 yards from the bridge. The next year we came back, it was about 3 feet. So we had to completely redo it again. Like I said, never any doubt about you had work to do. Because
right.
Every year, and that bridge that I told you about with the piers and the logs that we built and we worked so hard on, we had a huge flood. And it came down, and the piers were so well built, but the river scoured underneath them.
Oh, right.
And they just hauled them all, everything, downstream.
Do you remember what year that was?
Probably 1989.
And what bridge?
Mile and a half.
Okay.
You could still find those piers downstream from that spot. They're still intact.
Really?
Still rocking them.
I would think that eventually the river would have just eroded those piers away, too.
It did. That's what I'm saying. It did. It
no, but you said they're still there in chunks farther down.
No, the piers are still intact completely.
Yeah, I'm surprised. The power of water is pretty intense.
Yeah, but the power of those things were well built. I mean, they're not going anywhere. They'll rot out, but they're not going to...
Yeah.
They're not going to fall apart. They got 12-inch spikes in them.
Oh, okay. That helps.
Yeah.
And so you started in 1980. What was the last year you were up there?
2000.
And you want to talk about that last year?
Yeah, I mean, the last year, so March, April, we had a lot of snow that year. So Roy and I, they flew us up in a helicopter. Excuse me.
End it.
So that late fall, we had a big flood, and the logs came down and tore the underlayment cable off that suspension bridge, broke it. So it was a dangerous job, you know, but we had to fix it so people could get across the river. So Roy and I came down. We flew in. And then we had to snowshoe down because the snow was really deep. And we had the guys bring me in some new cable. And Roy couldn't swim, and the river was pretty high then, even that early in the spring.
I'm so surprised you could get up there in March or April.
We flew in.
Yeah, but you snowshoed. I guess that's why.
We flew into our camp, and then we snowshoed down to the bridge.
Okay.
And nevertheless, it was still deep. I mean, because it was, it took us forever to get to the bridge.
Yeah.
But it was a dangerous job. So I was underneath, I was stringing new underlayment cable in, pulling the old stuff out. And there's a chalk in there that's about
three inches?
It's about an inch diameter. And the cable comes down from this main cable. And then it ties into this chalk, and it's tied into the underlayment cable.
And what's a chalk? It's a Can you describe what a chalk is for those of us who don't know?
Yeah, it's a chalk. It's about 4 inches long, about an inch in diameter. It's got a hook on the end, and you hook into the cable into it.
Okay.
And then it hooks onto through the deck into the underlayment cable.
Okay.
Okay, so that's how you suspend that bridge. The deck is actually suspended from that main cable.
Okay.
So you're under a lot of PSI, pounds per square inch, right, that are coming down from that cable. And so I heard it snap. And the only thing that saved my life is I heard it snap because I twisted my neck really fast and it hit me right here.
Behind your ear?
Behind my ear, right where my vagus nerve comes down. And it knocked me down on the bridge, and I was out for a little bit, not very long. But I was in an incredible pain, and Roy came out and hauled me back in, and then we had to snowshoe up.
Oh, God.
But I had this, like, electrical shock that was going through me. It had affected my nerve.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like somebody putting a cattle prod in your neck, and that lasted. And then it started snowing, so we couldn't get a helicopter in. And so I was in intense pain for like 3.5 days. And eventually we just had to, Roy and I decided that, look, man, we got to get out of here. So we snowshoed out.
All the way out?
All the way out.
Holy cow.
8.5 miles.
And this is, you guys were trying to reattach this cable, and it snapped? Is that what was happening?
Yeah, it pulled through the deck.
Yeah.
And then hit me in the back of the head. And 2 weeks after that, I started having, like, panic attacks. I couldn't carry any weight anymore. It actually created what's called syringeal myelia. It's a cavity in my spinal cord. Got between C5 and C7. And it affected me neurologically. And then it brought back all the stuff that I'd suppressed from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So I started having, like, flashbacks.
You were having PTSD all over again.
I had serious PTSD. Because the only thing that really kept me from having it prior to that, because I don't know if you realize what a medevac corpsman is, but you can imagine what it is.
I can imagine what it is.
I had suppressed all that, but after this accident, it didn't work anymore. Because the parks has really helped me. There are a lot of Vietnam vets that were in the park, that mm-hmm. worked in the park. Well, after Glacier, almost every guy there was a Vietnam vet.
Hmm. It's interesting that the hitting that nerve, well, I guess it must have been the trauma of the event brought back the previous trauma. Is that how it...
Yeah, I brought back that, but it was just like it affected the amygdala and that shock and what they suspect. I mean, I've talked to neurologists about this. In fact, I see a neurologist to this day.
Mm-hmm.
It's been 20-some years that I still have, that's why I have chronic nausea.
Yeah. Head injuries will do that.
Yep, changed my whole life. After that, I couldn't carry a pack anymore. My neck wouldn't allow it. I worked for 2 more years. After
really?
That accident.
Wow. On the trail?
Mm-hmm. I didn't want to give it up, but it got to be so painful I couldn't deal it. But then I had to go through what ended up to be an incredibly arduous and emotionally devastating scenario with the Park Service. I'd missed maybe 3 days... 4 days of work and 20-some years in the park. Worked for the parks in 1973. And John Warder, the guy I told you about, when the neurologist gave him this, just said he can't work. He's got serious neurological problems from this. He just goes, I don't know what this gobbledygook is. I think I still never forget that word that he used. And I said, look, man, if I could work, I would, but I can't. So they actually tried to deny me my workman's comp. They tried to deny me but he wanted me to use my sick leave. I had to actually go to the regional office, and it took me 2 years to fight him. I fought with workman's comp for years.
Is that because you were a seasonal, do you think?
No, I was subject to furlough then.
Oh, okay.
I was a permanent employee. But they treated me, after all those years, I got so many commendations from the National Park Service. It's like they didn't even know me after that. Hmm. I have a lot of anger about that whole situation.
Yeah. Do you know why that they did that?
I have no idea.
But did you eventually...
What they eventually, because they have to offer you a different job or let you go. And by that time I was having like depression and anxiety, and I never had this prior to my accident ever. Mm-hmm. Who gets to see the hear of this anyway?
The public. Whoever.
Are they interested in listening to this part?
Well, it's part of your story that why you stopped working on the trail.
Yeah, I would have never stopped. I'd still be working up there today if I could.
Yeah, so that's why this how it relates.
But this is, this is what the Park Service does to people after they work for them so long. They don't. They didn't try. I mean, there were some people who did. I can't remember her name. She was acting superintendent of the park. She helped me immensely to get what was rightfully. I ended up having to medically retire because I worked as a construction supervisor for 25 years. And they wanted me to, they never asked me what I wanted to do. They just said, well, you can be the visitor use assistant. You can hand out pamphlets to the tourists. There's a guy in there who worked there. He was like 17 years old. I'm like, I'm not doing that. I can't work with the public that much anyway. I never have.
Right.
And so they tried to force me to do it. And I got an attorney, and I just said, and my doctors just said, there's no way you can do this. You can't work in the public. He's having flashbacks.
Right.
He's having all this from his military service. That didn't really enter into the equation. They didn't care. And so I suffered immensely from that.
Yeah. And eventually, though, you were able to medically retire?
I medically retired. And then several years after that, I was went through 3 years in the... was in three different PTSD clinics, spent a year in Hawaii in a PTSD clinic. All of this as a result of that accident, because I never had this.
And
I was 100% disabled. I was declared 100% disabled combat vet from 2009.
Okay. And so what year was the accident?
1995.
Okay. And then you officially...
Retired in 1999, just before 2000.
Okay. And then... What have you done since? You're here in Seattle.
I came down here to, I went to, and I had to go to the workman's compensation, and I got to know the director there very well, and he helped me get into the rehab, traumatic brain injury rehab at University of Washington. I went there for a year for that. I had like 8 different doctors and therapists. And while I was doing that, I decided, well, they told me then, that they said, look, you can never do this again. Your spine is permanently damaged.
Right.
I had to give up skiing. I had to give up hiking, backpacking. Said your spine won't take it if you fall at one time skiing. You could be paralyzed from the neck down. So it changed my whole life.
Yeah.
So I decided to do something different. So I applied to graduate school at the University of Washington in landscape architecture. Got my master's degree there. And then I got my PhD in landscape architecture.
Well, and that fits with building trails and...
Yeah, I mean, it was all,
readjusting
it's all about
the landscape.
Now what my research is on is combat-related trauma and the healing properties of nature. Therapeutic
awesome.
Gardens. And
great.
We built a few at the... We built it... therapeutic gardens, 3 different ones at the VA hospital here in Seattle. And we built them in Bosnia and Croatia and Sweden and Guatemala. And
Cool. Now, do you teach at the university?
Yeah, I have for 17 years.
Great. Well, it's amazing that that accident didn't kill you right there on the spot.
No, it was. I mean, that's what my doctor told me.
I didn't realize that you had walked out. I thought you'd been rescued by a helicopter.
No, we were, Roy and I walked out. We were snowshoed out.
Yeah.
Snowshoed down the river, actually.
I also didn't know it was just you and Roy. I thought it happened later in the construction season and there was a whole crew.
No, there was just the two of us. There was just the two of us. And then when I got out, we went immediately to the... took me immediately to the clinic in Skagway. And then I had to listen to people, well, you should have come here first. I went, screw that, man. I gotta come here first. I'm gonna go to the doctor first. I can't always, you know, deal with this.
Oh, that you didn't go to the Park Service first?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the trail crew was all under the maintenance department, right?
Correct. But the Clay Alderson was the superintendent then. Mm-hmm. And he didn't help me a hell of a lot either. And I helped him many times during his tenure there.
How did you help him?
Well, he got involved. I don't want to talk about him.
Okay.
But it's rather personal. He got, you know, with him and his wife, they separated. He got involved with somebody else. But they never came to me and just said, okay, you've been a great employee for all these years. What would you like to do? And we'll make that happen. No, they just tried to force this menial job and said, well, you'll get paid the same amount of money. I said, that's not what inspires me to do my job.
Yeah. Yeah, it does sound like you really enjoyed being out in the outdoors and on the trail.
Yeah, I mean,
so that must have been difficult.
I dedicated my whole life to that. I didn't care about money. I didn't care. Yeah. I mean, I worked from 73 to 2000, and that's... And I missed almost no time.
Yeah.
But yet they treated me like I was a leper.
Yeah, and it was an on-the-job accident, for sure.
Yeah, but they, you know, I don't know. I had to fight for everything I got, and that just made it more difficult for me.
Were there good things about the job?
About my job?
Yeah, but, you know, this is, unfortunately, it ended in a negative way, but...
No, I told you, of course there are good things. I've got nothing but great memories about the job. It's just the way I was treated after I got hurt.
Yeah, yeah.
That caused me, and even then, after that happened, Toni Horton, you know her?
I know the name.
She's a cultural landscape person out of Anchorage. She asked me to help her write the cultural landscape report for Chilkoot. Mm-hmm. And then I started working here in the summers at the Cultural Landscape Division of the Park Service. And I did a 7-year report at Crater Lake on restoration of the historic road.
Oh, that was out of the regional office here?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can you describe what a cultural landscape report is?
It's looking at all the cultural features, the design features, like all around the road of Crater Lake, all the stonework, all the turnouts that were... That were designed by a landscape architect during the Depression. It was Civilian Conservation Corps that did all those trails, did all those roads and trails, built most of the major national parks roads.
What about one for Klondike and Skagway? What's a landscape report there?
Looking at the trail itself, looking at the bridges, looking at all the constructed features. We never got to complete it.
Okay. Does it look at the artifacts that got left behind?
It, in a rudimentary manner, that's more of an archaeological study. That's more Carl's thing.
Mm-hmm.
We identify where they were, but mostly we're looking at the historical features of the park.
So when you were working on the trail, did you come across archaeological features and you had to stop and call?
All the time. And then we'd call up Carl and tell him to come up and check it out. He found all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, anything in particular you remember that was...
No, nothing. Neat. Nothing that seminal, as you know. We found a lot of horseshoes and a lot of old garbage. We found a lot of old garbage dumps, a lot of old cans and stuff that they just left.
Right. Do you know anything about the White Pass Trail? That side.
No, we were
things?
Supposed to do that, but we never did. Where they wanted us to build a trail into that, and which I was all for. I would love it. Would have loved to have done that, but it just never happened.
That's what I was wondering, is what your opinion of having a trail on the White Pass side?
I think by now that there's so little left there, and it'd be so expensive to build a trail into that site. You know, there's plenty of work to do on the Chilkoot. And then you have the logistics of getting people in and out of there, and then you'd have to have a ranger down in there. It'd be very expensive. And I don't know how much is left.
Well, even if there's nothing left, just the idea of it was a historic route.
Right.
And if but that should is, be...
Are you willing to... They were never willing to put the money into it. I would have had to hire a completely different crew.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking of it. Does the landscape there allow a trail to be...
It's very difficult. It's a lot of brush. I mean, you have to realize that all the valley before you get to Canyon City, that's all second growth timber. They clear cut all of that in the '50s. It's growing back. You can see it every year growing up to the conifers growing back up. It's kind of cool to watch it sort of come back.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, they had and a lot of those early folks got most of the artifacts. That, I mean. There wasn't a lot. I mean, they were carrying just basic fundamental stuff that they got. And then Roy and I did we built the enclosure at the cemetery there in Dyea.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of cool. We just sit there with the dead for like, you know, a month building an enclosure around it. Ate our lunch.
Did you talk to them?
All the time. Roy would always go, well, let's go see Unc Noe. Unc No. I go, who the hell is Unc No? You know, unknown. Yeah, we'd sit in there all the time and just, you know, you can feel their energy. You know, there's energy up there, especially at sheep camp. There's a lot of stuff going on at sheep camp.
Why particularly at sheep camp, do you think?
Well, that was the main camp before you went to the pass.
Went to the summit, yeah.
Not that many people stayed at Canyon City very long. They're in a hurry to get over the pass. And sheep camp was like the last stop before you hit the summit. But there was a lot of shit going on there. Like, some of the guys liked living up there. Roy and I hated it. We just wouldn't stay. We'd rather hike back to the camp. They'd all go, you're nuts, man. It's another 6 miles down there. I go, oh, we don't care. We're going. And then you got 22 hours of daylight, so it didn't matter.
Right.
And we knew that trail so well.
Yeah, you must have.
We used to go out, we'd run down the trail sometimes going out. Those are good days.
Yeah. And then I know you worked on the building restoration stuff, but I don't know if you want to talk about any of that.
No, I didn't do a lot on that. We did the lunch in Kennedy. We laid all the floor in there. I didn't do a lot of that. Roy did a lot of it.
Yeah, he talked about it in his interview.
Yeah, Roy did a lot of it. Roy's amazingly gifted. He's got an amazing skill set. He can do a lot of things.
Well, you must also. I mean, the fact that you did all that work on the trail and figured it out. And
well, the two of us together was just like, you know, I mean, we were like brothers. I mean, we never had a bad word between us in 20 years.
That's great.
And we lived together all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, we lived together more than he and his wife did. So. And Roy had never left Skagway. Only one other time, we worked on the pipeline till he met Doreen. Have mm-hmm. you ever met Doreen?
I haven't met her yet. I've emailed with her.
Doreen's a great woman.
Yeah.
Roy had never been out of Skagway till he met Doreen. Now he's been all over the world. She takes him everywhere.
That's good. Well, that is, he wants to do it. That's great.
Oh no, I was the best man at his wedding. So
that's cool. Well, I know that you're not feeling so great, so if there's anything else, any other stories or things you wanted to make sure...
No, there's a thousand stories I haven't gotten to. But, I mean, you can imagine in 20 years out there that there's so much stuff that happened. I mean, just getting building the base camp and putting in a water system and then having a filtration system for the water. And I mean, it was like... you know, later on, it was high living up there. I mean, we had glass windows and a roof, and we had running water at the sink. And
by what year was that you got it?
That was like 1988, started 89. put in a spring box and then ran about 1,000 feet of, no more than that, probably a couple thousand feet of pipe, PVC pipe that carried our water from the spring box.
What's a spring box?
It's a cedar box that we have a filtration little pipe that comes out. It's got a little filter on the end of it. We lay it in the creek, and then it goes into the box, fills the box up with water, and then the water, gravity fed, goes down to our camp.
Okay.
So the spring box was like up here, the camp was down here, so the mm-hmm. water would just run downhill. And then we had to fix it all the time because the bears would come and chew it. They love to chew on the pipe.
I've heard porcupines in other places.
Yeah, chew the pipe. I don't recall ever seeing any porcupines, but
I know in other
places.
The
bears certainly do. Mm-hmm. They like that and bar oil for the chainsaws.
Really?
They love to bite into that.
Huh. I would think that would not be tasty.
No, I think it's something about the viscosity of the oil. Hmm. They liked. Hmm. But it was, I miss it every time. Every time I think about it, I wish I could go back, and I wish I had never left. The only thing that made me ever want to leave was the accident.
Yeah, I'm sorry that
Roy
happened.
Roy got tired of it. But...
Well, and it is, as I say, it's such hard work. Even with the accident, it is the kind of thing that you end up timing out of. Your body just can't do it anymore.
No, I mean, when I quit, I was, 47 years old. No, I was older than that. My last year, I think I was 49. So I did it from 23 to 49.
That's good. But I see, that kind of work, your body's just going to give out eventually.
Well, my knees hurt a lot.
Yeah.
But it makes you strong, too. I mean, you're strong. You're stronger than you'll ever be any other time in your life.
Yep. But it's great. At that age, you went back to school and got a master's and a PhD.
Yeah, I mean, I was... I love school, too, but I really miss Alaska. I don't really like living in Seattle. There's no real sense of community here. Not like it is in Alaska.
Yeah.
Alaska's a special place.
Well, and Skagway's a small town compared to Seattle being a big city.
It is, but people are, you know, they look out for you there. You know, when I had my surgery for my cancer, all my buddies that worked for me at Glacier, they came here and stayed with my dog while I was in the hospital, and they stayed with me.
Nice.
Roy came here and stayed with me for 3 weeks. I mean, that's the sort of camaraderie we had, is that people who came when I needed them were all the guys they worked with Trails on.
Yeah, I think there's something about that working as a team in really harsh conditions.
Yeah, it's similar to being in the military in Vietnam. It's the same sort of esprit de corps, and, you know, you got everybody six, you're always watching out for each other.
Yeah.
Which we always did. You know, there was no... there's no egos involved with our work. It's when we got to town was where the egos came in.
Yeah. Well, and as you say, there's also safety. You got to watch out for each other.
Yeah, there were safety issues all the time. It was dangerous work. Roy and I both have got more than one scar from working on that trail.
Yeah, I'm surprised that, yeah, somebody didn't get washed down the river, or you guys never had to, somebody didn't have to be medevaced out by helicopter.
Well, I got washed down the river more than once, but we medevaced out a lot of hikers, but none of us.
So yeah, now they have rangers stationed along the trail.
They always did.
They did, even when you were there working.
Yeah, some of them were good. Some of them rarely left the cabin.
Yeah.
But they had a ranger at sheep camp. And then they would go up and back. They'd go up to the pass every day and then come back. But there was no ranger in Canyon City. And a lot of them were afraid of bears, terrified of them. We used to have the bears come and sit. When we were building the suspension bridge, these big old black bears used to come and just, there's a little pond. We had built a little bridge over that before you got to a little rivulet that came where the overflow in the river. On the stream, I should say, and they just lay in the water and watch us work. And we never bothered them. They never bothered us. So it was pretty cool. But they'd come through our camp all the time. You could see their tracks in the morning. But they never messed with us.
Yeah, mutual respect.
Absolutely. I love bears. They're amazing animals. But I knew the guy. You heard of the guy that got... He thought he could commune with the bears. And
oh, yeah.
I actually knew a guy that that funded him. He was out of L.A. He had this called Environment Now, and he gave that guy some money to study bears. And I met with him one time, and he starts telling me, yeah, I can talk to bears. They understand me, and they'd never hurt me. I go, don't say that, man. You don't ever know what a bear is going to do. It's an animal.
It's a wild animal.
You can never take anything a bear does for granted. And I said, you may get away with it for a while, but it's going to catch up with you. I told him that specifically. The one time I met him in person, because he was real arrogant about it, I just said, one day it's not going to work for you. Sure as hell it didn't.
And well, you guys are lucky on the trail that it didn't catch up with any of you.
Yeah, absolutely. But we were not that arrogant about animals, you know, that you're going to go lay down next to them and their cubs, and never felt that. You don't do that with animals, you know.
Right.
You have to respect them, and it was unfortunate that it cost him his life, and then the woman that he loved life as well.
Right.
Oh, that's another. I'll tell you that great story before I go. Is that they one year I don't remember what year it was, but Ted Stevens was still alive then. And you know Brooks Camp?
Mm-mm. Brooks Brooks Camp. Oh, yeah. Brooks Camp. I thought you were saying like there's somebody's name. Yeah, no, I've been to Brooks Camp. Yeah.
So they brought us up from, because we were the only real construction crew in the state for the Park Service. So Stevens decided he wanted to build a bear viewing platform for his congressional buddies to come and hang out at Brooks Camp. And so they flew us up. Roy and I and Mike Byerly and John Warder to build this thing for them. And it cost them tens of thousands of dollars just to get us out. You know how much it costs to get out there.
Yeah.
But then they had to bring a barge out with all the materials that we needed. And so they brought all this barge. It took us like a month to build this thing. And we had to leave the Chilkoot. And there was one guy that we left on the Chilkoot just to keep the brush on the lower end. But we worked 10, 12 hours a day on this thing to get it done. And the bears were just starting to come down. And so we get it all built. And we get the gate up and everything. And we're looking around. And this is all right. So Stevens flies in. In a float plane, gets out of the float plane, and then the guy in charge of Brooks Camp comes out, and Steven says, looks good now. Gets back on the float plane, takes off. It's been like 5 minutes there. So we get our final gear, and we're getting ready to go, and he goes, the guy who's the head of the park there just goes, this is going to be great for the tourists. They can be up here. The bears won't bother this place at all, and you know, they won't come around this because it was quite a bit off the ground. And, I think it was about 8 feet off the ground. And we start to walk down a trail there and go across. I don't know if it's still there or not. I haven't been there shit since we did it. Start to walk back to the campground. And a bear came up and ripped the gate down. And about three of them got up there and they put their paws up. And they're standing on the rail looking at us. It was fantastic.
That's great.
Because the bear viewing platform was for the bears viewing us.
That's right.
It was fantastic, man. We got the biggest kick out of that. And John was just like, Paul, get those bears out of there. I go, oh, no, man, don't mess with those bears. It's great.
That's great.
I got a picture of that, so that's pretty
good.
Cool.
That's good. I've been there, and there was a bear viewing platform up at the falls.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's the same one you built.
Yeah, we put it in 15 years ago, more than that. 15 years
before
I don't remember what year it was.
I can't
then
remember.
We hiked into the Valley of 10,000 Smokes. That was fantastic.
Yeah, I can't remember what year I was there. I'd have to figure that out. But
it was great to see those bears. It just ripped that big old gate off and They're up there with their paws, on their paws on the railing, just looking at us like, going, hey, suckers, thanks. We like this.
Well, that's great. There was something else I was going to ask you, and I can't remember what it was. I got distracted by the bears at Katmai, but that's okay. The
bears at Katmai those were big bears. Those are brown bears, coastal bears.
Yeah.
We don't get them that big as...
Well, in Skagway, you get the brown bears. They're just not
grizzlies.
As big. Yeah.
They're not as big.
Yeah.
A lot of black bears, but not like those bears.
Yeah.
They're immense. Yeah. But they're great animals. Nothing like... And when I was at Glacier, we had a lot of bears at Glacier.
Yeah.
Okay, I better go get home to my dog.
Yeah, I appreciate all your time today. Thank you.